From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You would think the case of the wedding cake baker who refused to make a cake for a gay couple in Colorado is about religion. The baker, Jack Phillips, does have a religious objection to same-sex marriage, but the case he's making before the U.S. Supreme Court, that he has a right not to make the cake, isn't based on his religious liberty. Phillips is basing his case on another part of the First Amendment, the right to free expression. The fact is, he would probably lose if this were about religious freedom, but if, as he says, his cakes are expression, that's something different. And it's unclear how the court will see Jack Phillips' cakes as art or just as food. Today in the program, we've gathered our two local legal experts who follow the court and try and read the cues they get from oral arguments. We'll talk about the case of the Masterpiece Cake Shop today after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They're one of 24 children's hospitals in the country that's been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for providing excellent care in all 10 pediatric specialties. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. After all the briefs have been filed in cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, our first glimpse of how the justices may be thinking about all of them comes in oral arguments. And sometimes you can tell a lot about the mind of a justice by the questions she asks or the way she treats a particular side. If you're an observer, it's kind of like solving a mystery. You look at the questions, the back and forth between the justices, even their tone, their body language, and then you make a guess. Well, even the best observers of the Supreme Court are having a hard time making a guess about the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, which went before the court yesterday. This is about the Colorado baker who refused to make a custom wedding cake for a gay couple. The baker is Jack Phillips, and he says he's not just a baker, he is an artist, and that his cakes are his act of expression and therefore protected by the U.S. Constitution. The New York Times reporter Adam Liptak was there for the oral arguments. He thought the court would come down on the side of the baker, 5-4. David Savage of the Los Angeles Times thought it would come down on the side of the gay couple, 5-4. So, who knows? Today in the program, we may ask our own experts to make their own guesses. So we're going to be talking about the case today, the legal questions behind it, and the way it played out in the Supreme Court yesterday. Rennell Anderson-Jones is back with us, a law professor at the University of Utah, clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, writes about the media and the Supreme Court. And welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Amy Wildermuth back with us, a professor also at the University of Utah's S.J. Cooney College of Law, clerked for Justice John Paul Stevens. Her work focuses on the Supreme Court and on administrative law. And welcome back to you.
Great to be here.
Okay, so I guess we should start with just give us a sense. Let's talk about some broad things first, and we'll set up the – I think a lot of people know the particulars of the case, but I want to get into some of that. But first of all, let's start with significance. Just how significant is this case? It's been pointed out it's not the most consequential on the docket this year, but a lot of people are paying a lot of attention to it for various kinds of reasons. What do you think? How big a deal is this?
I think it's a very big deal as a cultural marker. And that might be a different thing than being a very big deal in terms of jurisprudence, although I also think it's a decently big deal in terms of jurisprudence because it's at the sort of crossroads of two lines of jurisprudence. And one of the things that's really interesting about this case is that it is about exactly what it sounds to be about. So lots of times we come together, law professors in particular feel like they have to translate what's happening at the Supreme Court to the population that hasn't followed Supreme Court jurisprudence. And a lot of times we're telling a story about the facts of a case and then explaining, you know, the case isn't really about the sort of these facts aren't as relevant. There's something sort of about the statute or about the Constitution that's going on here. Here, it's about what it's about.
Yeah.
The tension is really readily apparent, which is there's this line of precedent about free speech and free expression, and there's a line of precedent about public accommodation and LGBT rights. And this is where the rubber hits the road between the two of them. And I think that makes it a case of consequence.
That's what I love about this case, because it's not so much about all the arcane stuff that I just zooms past me. This is, it's just, it's right there in front of you. You can absolutely see what it's about.
And I think the justices really hesitated. I mean, I think we can see that in sort of the history of this case in terms of taking this case. Mm-hmm. There are lots of good questions about whether this was the best vehicle, the best kind of facts scenario to take this kind of question. And it took a long time for this case to get granted.
Yeah.
So I think we have to keep that in mind as we're thinking about what might happen in this case. This is a very quick turnaround from Obergefell. You have a moment where we say gay marriage is legalized, right, for the country. And then very shortly thereafter, we have an accommodations case on that. And the accommodations case, interestingly enough, is arising from facts before we get
Obergefell. This was 2012.
Exactly. So it's quite fascinating from a few different angles.
Okay, I want to play a moment. The New York Times podcast, The Daily, focused yesterday on this case, and they spoke with Jack Phillips. He's the baker that I mentioned there. Basically, what happens, this is in 2012, this gay couple, Charlie Mullins and David Craig, they go to this cake shop because they'd heard good things about Jack's cakes. Apparently, does a really great job. And they asked for a custom wedding cake for their upcoming wedding. And as Jack Phillips told the New York Times, it wasn't a very long conversation.
Two gentlemen came into my shop. They had a folder with them and had my wedding books open. And so I went over and sat down with them, introduced myself. We exchanged names, and they said, "We're here to look for wedding cakes." Mm-hmm. "And it's for our wedding." And so I tried to respectfully explain to them that, "I'm sorry, guys, I don't do cakes for same-sex weddings, but I would be glad to sell them anything else that I had in the shop." Mm-hmm. And they were surprised. They, you know, "What are you talking about?" Then they stood up, swore at me, and stomped out of the shop immediately. That mm-hmm. was as far as we got.
Now, the couple were humiliated, right? I mean, they've talked about their side of the story. We'll hear a little bit more from them later. But this is so interesting because Jack Phillips, he has religious objections to same-sex marriage. But he doesn't – he will sell all of his products mm-hmm. to gay couples. He doesn't have a problem with that. He will even make them a wedding cake, but he won't make a custom wedding cake. And here's where the distinction is. Talk about – this particular thing, because this makes it kind of unique.
So I think the really interesting part of this case is that many, many folks leading up to the case focused on the religious aspect.
Yep.
But it didn't get argued as that kind of case. Certainly religion informed how Jack reacted to this couple. But they are really talking much more, once we get to argument, about how we should think about bakers or cake artists, which is what they want to frame this as.
And not even bakers, artists.
Right,
more, right?
As artists.
Yeah.
That this is an expression. And once we frame it that way, how does that make us think about the free speech aspects of it? And that's why you have folks coming in on each side making arguments about when you express yourself and whether traditionally bakers could be considered artists mm-hmm. or something along those lines.
And it should be noted that if this case had been argued as a freedom of religion, as a pure free exercise of religion case,
Jack would have lost.
Jack would have lost quite resoundingly.
Yeah. Thanks, absolutely.
Thanks to some case law from the recently passed Justice Antonin Scalia, who was a conservative lion and in many respects one of the greatest supporters of free speech, but also of religious freedom in this country. But in a case called Employment Division versus Smith, he said, writing for a majority, when you are a religious person who has an objection to the application of a generally applicable law to you, in that case, it was actually a drug law.
Yep.
So they said, you know, everybody has to obey this drug law. Nobody can use drugs in these classifications. And there were people who ingested peyote as a part of their religious ceremony, and they wanted a carve out to say that that law shouldn't apply to us because of our religious freedom. And Justice Scalia quite resoundingly said no.
Yep.
And said, if it's just a generally applicable law, on, it's not targeting you. You have to obey it because the wider social norms are at stake here. And so,
and that's settled now. Everyone pretty much agrees on that.
People, certainly religious liberty organizations still wish that that was not the case. But it's clear as a matter of constitutional law. There's statutory law that has emerged to try to overcome that in some contexts. But as a matter of constitutional law, Jack Phillips would have no First Amendment right to say a generally applicable public accommodations anti-discrimination law doesn't apply to me because of my Christian views. He couldn't assert that.
Yeah. What he did assert instead was another part of the First Amendment, and that is that freedom of expression part. Before we get to that, I actually want to say it seems so interesting the way this case came to the court. A lot of the times you have different interests and they go searching for plaintiffs. That didn't really happen here. It seems like this was a more organic way. And in some ways, if you are for religious liberties or you're conservative and you want and you're concerned about same-sex marriage or those kinds of – it doesn't seem like that ideal of a case really, because like a photographer, that would have been an ideal case.
Yes.
But a baker is like, really? Is a cake a form of expression? So it's interesting, this particular case, it's flawed in some ways, but it's interesting the way it came about.
I think that's absolutely true. I don't know that there's a group of folks on either side who would have said, yes, this is the case that we want going forward. It's too tough when you get to, you know, either side of the argument. Again, your point about photographers, there's actually much more agreement, I would say, among scholars in terms of photographers than you would see for bakers. Yeah. And so in that way, you know, if you're on the religious side of this, this is not your best case. That's absolutely true.
I've heard it described then, that is conservatives, religious conservatives. I've heard this tactic of looking at not religious liberty part of the First Amendment, but free expression as kind of, I think Liptak called it the new lever from conservatives. Rennell, you've said they're basically weaponizing a different body of law. Talk about this as a tactic, because it seems like that's what's going on.
I think this is absolutely a trend that we have seen in the Roberts Court since Chief Justice John Roberts became the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. The scope and breadth of First Amendment jurisprudence, and particularly free speech and free expression jurisprudence, has really expanded to become a mechanism for challenging all sorts of the entirety of the regulatory state in many respects. So we now see First Amendment jurisprudence being the basis for challenging things like corporate behavior and union behavior and commercial speech, and it is very much a sort of libertarian tool for suggesting that the government cannot tell a person or an entity how to behave. Mm. And this is sort of the latest, I think, in a quite long trend toward that use, that expansive use of First Amendment doctrine. And speech jurisprudence bears a great deal of weight in all of this because it's sort of the go-to when other things don't work. And we see it doing that here, where a straight-up religious freedom challenge wouldn't be successful. But we have this body of precedent that has been mounting over the years, expanding free speech rights. And so casting this instead as a forced expression with this kind of undercurrent that shows itself all over the place in the briefs and all over the place in the oral argument about religious freedom. So you get to think about religious freedom and the rights of religious minorities, but you don't have to decide it on that doctrine. And that's something we're seeing in a lot of areas.
You know what's brilliant about this in some ways, too, is really the only justice that matters is Kennedy in this, right? Because we know where the other four are, you know, on the right. We know where the other four are on the left. And Kennedy, on one hand, of course, he writes what some believe to be this majestic opinion in Obergefell. He is an advocate for LGBT rights. Or at least expressing
them. He's the architect of that whole line of cases.
The whole line.
We just have to
Lawrence,
say, right, start at Lawrence. Yep. You have to say he's the architect for all of it.
But
absolutely.
Then he's also a really big advocate for free speech. So this is such an interesting conflict for him, it must be.
Oh, yeah. I think what this brings out in Kennedy is a very difficult question, right? If you are passionate about both of these issues, how are you going to, and it's terrible to say it, split the baby, right? How are you going to decide that those two things can coexist? And in several opinions, and in Obergefell itself, you see Kennedy struggling with this. And one thing that I think is really important to this conversation is to understand that Kennedy has taken a position that dissenters should be able to dissent. Yep. And so how is that going to sort of manifest? How are we going to allow that? If you disagree with gay marriage, how can we allow you to do that and still sort of have all of the respect and dignity around gay marriage? It's a very tough question.
Yeah. In many respects, what this is he's coming into the crosshairs of his own minority protection instincts, right? If you see those minority protection instincts driving the LGBT rights cases, right, it's really behind Lawrence. It's very much behind Obergefell that these folks want to get married. They've been at this sort of fringe place in society. They deserve to have the full scope of constitutional liberties that the rest of us have, and that motivates a lot of his language and the prose of the opinion.
Yep.
But he also seems to perhaps feel that way about
conservative Christians.
Christians right. who have found themselves in the minority in terms of their viewpoint about this. This issue in the cultural war, and he wants to make sure that they, even if they are the losers in terms of sort of national trend on this, have a voice, that they have the opportunity to dissent, and that's important to him to think about minority protection. And this case just forces two underprotected minorities to come together in a decision that I think is going to be really hard for him, and that you see from the oral argument might be really hard for him.
And if I might, I just want to offer just a very quick quote from Hobby Lobby, which is not a First Amendment case, but very controversial to many people. Justice Kennedy's concurring opinion, he says, "In our constitutional tradition, freedom means that all persons have the right to believe or strive to believe in a divine creator and a divine law." I mean, this is going to be a very tough case for him. That's what we have to understand.
I kept hearing time and time again yesterday and just reading the coverage of this that where Kennedy has said to multiple people, losers get to complain.
Yes.
They have the right to be able to complain. So, yeah, he's going to be really conflicted by all of this. We'll come back to one of the principles that he mentioned in oral arguments yesterday, where he really went after the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And let's come back to that in just a moment. I want to say a little bit more about this First Amendment question, because it's so interesting the way you're hearing First Amendment advocates talking about this particular case. One thing that Adam Litvak in the New York Times has said in reporting this is that this is really testing the deep and longstanding commitments to free speech. And it's divided these old allies. Everyone was on the same page in some ways about free speech, but they're not on this case for different reasons. Now, Floyd Abrams is a prominent First Amendment advocate, of course. And he told Adam Liptak this in the New York Times. Let me quote some of this. He said, at first blush, he said that the position of the baker had a lot of appeal for me. There was no reason to doubt his position, that this was an act of conscience on his part. So he thought, you know, that makes sense. But he says the more he thought about it, the more he thought of other possibilities. And he said, could a painter invite the public to his gallery at which he painted portraits for them for a fee but refused to paint black people? Could a musician invite the world into a studio where he wrote songs about them for a fee but refused to do so for Jews or Muslims? He said the First Amendment protects a lot, but not that conduct.
Yeah. And I have to say that brief that you just referred to, probably one of the best briefs, not just in this case, but probably one of the best briefs that you have seen in most Supreme Court cases. And let me just say here, It is a total of, I believe, 11 or 12 pages, which is just unheard of.
So short.
So it is, I mean, we don't, lawyers just don't write in 12 pages. Yeah. I don't know how to do that, right?
Right.
So it was fascinating that this brief has been so important to this case and to really change the dialogue about how people are thinking about the particular issue in this case.
And the signatories really are truly all of the heavy hitters, right? It's Robert Post, who was the dean at Yale, and it's Jeff Stone, who was the dean at Chicago, and it's Floyd Abrams, who is the nation's preeminent First Amendment lawyer, who always, you know, uniformly, even when wildly unpopular with his political allies, favors free speech. It's Kathleen Sullivan, who was the dean at Stanford. It is a really interesting upside down world, right? What has happened to the world when the major case, major First Amendment case before the Supreme Court this term, has a beautifully written, powerful brief from the nation's preeminent First Amendment scholars, all arguing against the free speech argument. It's really interesting.
Then there's another argument that's coming up for people who are saying that same-sex weddings do have free speech implications, but that a photographer, for example, that baking a cake just isn't speech, that the media, the means of the communication matters. Photography is speech. A painting may be speech, but sorry, a cake just isn't.
Yeah, and this is the Eugene Volokh brief.
Right.
I mean, this is
He's at UCLA.
Correct. And he is a well-known professor there, and he also has a well-known blog, the Volokh blog that he organizes and oversees. And I have to say, one of the really fascinating things about his brief is that it basically says the baker should lose, but there's a bunch of people who win.
Yep.
And it really goes to that creative expression. How do we think about artists and how could, and it sort of turns the tables here, right? Would we be okay limiting people who are musicians, writers, historically, right? And through that lens says there are a group of folks that the government couldn't sort of regulate and limit. And therefore, that group of folks, which he includes photographers and musicians in, but not the bakers.
Yep.
And that's sort of where he draws a line. So in that sense, if that argument was to gain traction, it would be a win in this particular case, but it would be pretty limited for a lot of other cases that would come along.
This line drawing question, I think, predominated oral argument yesterday.
Really?
In terms of sort of, I mean, if you read through the transcript, it's just sort of like a page about whether hairstylists are expressing themselves and whether makeup artists, they call themselves artists, right? The actual word artist is right there in the makeup artist title.
And that got a good giggle.
Got a good chuckle. That's the kind of thing people laugh
Kagan?
At.
Is this Kagan?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Kagan and Sotomayor both, and Ginsburg also sort of pushed back a big list of them, right? Architecture, jewelry, the people who make the invitations, or they're sort of pressing about all of these questions. And there's actually a body of First Amendment doctrine that answers this question a little bit. So one of the ways that we have a body of First Amendment doctrine that says, if you're doing something rather than speaking, if you're engaging in conduct, then we have a little test that we apply to try to figure out whether that expression rises to the, that conduct rises to the level of being expressive enough that it's the equivalent of speech. Because remember, the First Amendment just says you have a right of freedom of speech. So your conduct has to become speechy in order for you to get it protected.
It's an expression.
Yes.
Yep.
Right. That's the technical term. And the way that we do this ordinarily is sort of a two-pronged analysis, where first we ask whether you, the doer, or rather the expressor, meant to say something, whether you thought you were
being... Because a doer is different than an expressor.
That's right.
Okay,
but you're trying to get your conduct to be seen as speech. So here in this context, for example, did Jack Phillips, the baker, did he think that he was doing something artistic and expressive and that he was saying something, namely, I approve of this wedding? And we think the record, I actually think the record is quite clear that Jack is a person of good faith who actually holds this belief that his cake is a creation, that it is expressive, that he is an artist, and that it says specifically, I approve of the wedding for which I made the cake, right? So on Jack's sort of subjective piece of the test, it seems like there is expression.
Yeah.
But the second piece of the test is whether the hearers, right, the audience of this expression.
Those of us who see that cake, do we see it as
that's right. And right. That's harder, right? Yep. Because I've been to lots of weddings and there are cakes there and they're beautiful. And I might say that cake is gorgeous or that cake is delicious. I'm not sure that I would say that baker definitely approves of the union of these two people, right? Because that's not necessarily the message that a cake conveys.
Yep.
Even if that cake was going to, even if he was afraid that that cake would convey that message, the Colorado Court of Appeals said, you know, you're free to put up a little sign that says, don't read anything into the conveyance of this cake. This cake is produced by Masterpiece Cake Shop. Masterpiece Cake Shop doesn't approve or disapprove of any weddings. It doesn't have anything to say about those things. And people actually reading that sign would think, that's a weird sign, because it never occurred to me in the first instance that the baker had any views about this wedding. He's just making a cake. Even if it's a very beautiful cake and even if it's unique to this, it's a little harder to get to that second piece. And I think you see that second piece playing out in all of this oral argument questioning. They're really pushing as to whether are other people seeing all of these services as communicative.
Let me go back to Eugene Volokh, because I want to quote from his the summary of his friend of the court brief. He said, this First Amendment right must have its limits. The First Amendment shields refusals to speak, but generally not refusals to do things. Limousine drivers, hotel operators, caterers should not have a free speech clause right to exempt themselves from anti-discrimination law. He says the same limit should apply to wedding cake makers. Now, here's what else he writes, and this is interesting. This case, he says, calls on the court to define those limits while still preserving the rights of those who are genuinely being coerced into creating First Amendment protected expression.
Yeah.
Like that's so it seems like that's what they've got to figure out.
Yeah. And if we could just for a second go back and contrast this with the Floyd Abrams brief so that we understand sort of where different folks are coming from. The Floyd Abrams brief basically says, look, if you are a cake baker and you put messages on a cake, you are opening yourself up for any individual to come in and ask for that cake with that message. So if it says, God bless this marriage, it doesn't matter. The individual's identity cannot change whether you're going to have that message or not. In other words, that's the distinction that they're drawing. The contrast to this, the Volokh brief, right, is saying, okay, we've got to put all of these different artisans or artists or doers in different categories, and that's how we're going to figure out if it's speechy enough.
Right.
And really, I don't think in the transcript we have a consensus around what we're going to do on that question.
Okay, I'm going to get in trouble if I don't take a break. So let's do that right now. Amy Wildermuth, you just heard from, teaches law here at the University of Utah. Ranelle Anderson-Jones also teaches. There are two Supreme Court experts. We've gathered them here to talk about the oral arguments in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case from yesterday. But we need to take a break. So we'll do that and then come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, is a wedding cake a piece of art, an act of artistic expression? And if it is it speech that is protected by the Constitution? Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case of a Colorado baker who refused to make a custom wedding cake for a gay couple. Does he have the right to say no? Today in the program, we're talking about how the argument played out yesterday in the high court. We have with us Amy Wildermuth, professor at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law, Ranelle Anderson-Jones, also a law professor there. We're talking about what happened. Okay, so let's lay out the scene for me if you can. I know you weren't there, but this thing went for 90 minutes. What does that mean? Because it only goes for usually an hour, if that, right?
It means the justices were generous. They don't have to be.
Right.
When the red light on the podium goes on, you are required to stop speaking even if you are mid-sentence and then look to the Chief Justice for permission to continue. But the justices were eager. It was a very hot court. They were asking a lot of questions from both sides, lots of line-drawing questions that we were talking about before, and lots of concerns being expressed from both sides of the aisle, both the conservative justices and the liberal justices, about how how an opinion in this case could be tailored. And so lots of extensions of time were given to all three of the folks who stepped to the podium. There was a lawyer on behalf of the gay couple, a lawyer on behalf of the baker, and also the Solicitor General, who represents the United States interests, was given some time at oral argument. And so each of these three got lots and lots of questions and had lots and lots of responses, which means 30 extra minutes of argument time, which is rare.
And also the Colorado SG, we should mention, was also included. So this was just, there were a lot of lawyers coming up. In a traditional case, you'd see two lawyers, yeah, one for each side. Yeah. We had a lot of folks coming up to the podium. They had only scheduled one argument yesterday. And so lots of people had speculated that they would extend the time, just given the circumstances and the number of players involved.
So I'm not going to ask you to guess yet, but I think I will, so just be ready. But it is interesting, and I mentioned this in the introduction, from what observers were seeing, not everyone agreed. Like, as I said, Adam Littak from The Times said, oh, this is, I think, going to go on down on the side of Jack Phillips. The Los Angeles Times said, nah, I think it's going to go down on the side of Colorado. So it was pretty hard to read. Do you agree with that, at least?
I think it was pretty hard to read. I think the other thing is sort of what you went into the argument thinking. Mm-hmm. Adam Littak had done a podcast with Dahlia Lithwick on her Amicus podcast, and he had laid out there that he was thinking the baker could win. And so I think because of the nature of Justice Kennedy's questions across the board, it was still pretty difficult to figure out where he might end up. Yeah. And I think it was really heavily influenced by what you went into the argument thinking might
I noticed
happen.
That everybody who is making a prediction about the outcome, they're differing about their predictions, but they're not differing about the data that drives their predictions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody agrees that the tea leaves we're reading are the things Anthony Kennedy said out loud, yeah, at this opinion. At this argument. And really, the question is just how much weight you give to each of these. And there's a lot at stake here, right? He is, in fact, unquestionably the swing vote here. And we hear him saying in oral argument a few things that seem to favor the gay couple, right? He is quite concerned about their dignitary interest. He asks a question about whether could we envision down the line window signs, yep, at bakeries across America saying we don't bake cakes or we don't bake custom cakes for gay couples. And you can hear the sort of resonating sort of notion in his I'm assuming that what's driving this question is are we gonna make people uncomfortable in a way that this is sort of a little too Jim Crow-ish? Does, yep, this start to take on the notion that there is
a
sign that says, you know, colored water fountains? Is this going to feel like that?
And well, Kennedy said in response to that question, he said, you don't think that would be an affront to the gay community?
Right. So he's talking about dignitary rights, right? He's concerned about that vibe. And but conversely, he's also saying some things that I think have to give pause to folks who thought that who were giving way to that and that seemed to favor the baker.
OK, so let me mention that. So he was really critical, it seemed to be anyway, of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, one of the commissioners who used the word despicable.
Yes.
He said, the commissioner said this, and to me, it is one of the most despicable pieces of rhetoric that people can use to use their religion to hurt others. Kennedy hated that.
And he had company in hating that, right? Of the four that we consider traditionally conservative on the court, at least those that spoke up on this point, it seemed pretty clear that that was very upsetting to them. The other point that we should say that seemed to be a big bone of contention was this training point, so that if Jack Phillips is found to have violated this law, he's supposed to get training on, you know, how we treat people with respect and what he
had
done.
Train your employees, right? and your, right, family members who,
exactly,
are employees.
Exactly. And this conflict with his religious beliefs, yep, and that training, in quotes, right, seemed to upset quite a few people.
So, and I think it's really worth noting that the language that Kennedy says from the bench in response to this suggestion that the commissioners had animus towards religion, right? That they thought that a religious objection was despicable. His response to that really taps into some of those themes that we were talking about.
Can I read it?
Yeah.
He said, tolerance is essential in a free society, and tolerance is most meaningful when it's mutual. It seems to me that the state in its position here has been neither tolerant nor respectful of Mr. Phillips' religious beliefs.
I think that is the money quote from yesterday's oral argument.
Really?
I do. I think that that taps into, right, because our question is, which way does Justice Kennedy's dignitary harm concern, which way does his minority protection instinct strike? And he's suggesting that he has a serious concern about the lack of tolerance shown to the baker, and that that strikes me as a really important signal. He followed that up immediately. The very next breath was, and these bakers' objections didn't stop Charlie and David from getting a cake. There were many other bakeries available, and they could be accommodated by going to another bakery, right? So he's sort of summarizing the key points of the baker's brief in sort of one moment from the bench, and I think that's a pretty big signal.
Was that a tell from him, do you think, if you're just trying to add this stuff up?
I think that you should look at Hobby Lobby.
Renelle is shaking her head like, I don't know.
I will go ahead and go on record and
people
say
who
I think
are physically present don't know. Yeah, but
I think that there's a bit more than just a tell, because you can go to Hobby Lobby, that concurrence, and it says, among the reasons the United States is so open, so tolerant, and so free is that no person may be restricted or demeaned by government in exercising his or her religion. It's not just that question at argument. It's that this echoes in so many things that he has written.
Yeah.
It's interesting that it seems like you could make the argument that Kennedy could have been moved more by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission if they had just been a little nicer.
Yes.
Like, it's almost like the Colorado, they blew it.
Yes.
It's a very bad fact for them. I mean, I actually think if we're sort of making guesses about outcome and we think that that's the money quote, we think we've sort of honed in on the fact that this is the thing that really is sort of irritating Justice Kennedy or making him feel concerned. The very narrowest route here is that he could vote to invalidate based on this statement by this one or maybe two commissioners.
Because it was an act of bias.
That, right. Correct. Actual animus or viewpoint discrimination in the application of the Colorado public accommodations law. But that would be a case-specific outcome, and it would leave Colorado and other states free to enforce civil rights laws of this sort against expressive entities in the future. In fact, they could return it to just be heard by a non-biased commission, right?
Yeah, correct.
That would be the very narrowest way that the baker technically wins, but that we don't end up with constitutional jurisprudence that suggests that there's a carve-out for everybody everywhere who believes their work to be expressive.
But that just kicks the can down the road, doesn't
it?
Are the justices keen on doing that, or are they like, let's solve this thing?
So if it's up to Kennedy, my guess would be that Kennedy would not see that as big and majestic enough. And so I don't think that is how it will come out. Doesn't mean it won't, but the odds are that it probably won't end up that way.
We need to take another break, but let me ask one more thing before when we come back, I want to talk about race, because that was such a fascinating part of this conversation. But this also came up. How much does it matter that same-sex marriage in 2012 was not, in fact, legal in Colorado? Now, the couple were going to get married in Massachusetts, where it was, but this
Correct.
Dispute plays out in Colorado, where it wasn't quite legal. I think Alito brought this up.
Yes.
He's clearly thinking that's significant, or hoping Kennedy thinks that's significant, I guess, right?
And that would also be a very narrow ground,
yeah,
because then it would be another distinction that then doesn't exist in 2017, 2018, right? So is that the way that we see this getting decided? It would be one of these things, again, like our other option of sending it back to a non-biased commission. It's possible, and it would be a very narrow ground and probably not really meaningful in the bigger scope of things. I just don't know, again, that that's big and majestic enough for our friend Justice Kennedy.
Yeah, it would be a bizarre holding, right, to suggest technically this didn't conflict with a constitutional right at the very moment that it was decided. But everybody going forward from this moment of this opinion on knows that it is a constitutional
totally.
Right.
Totally. And I figure, like, and, come on, you guys are Supreme Court justices.
Yeah.
Resolve this thing. And, so what if that technicality happens?
And the answer is, if you think that that's a technicality, you don't take the case.
Exactly.
They don't have to take a case. Their docket is discretionary. They had choices in picking a vehicle, a case that they thought
and four,
was appropriate.
And four had to agree to take the case,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And they did. Okay. All right. Amy Wildermuth with us, professor at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. Rennell Anderson-Jones, also a law professor there. We need to take another break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Salt Lake County Animal Services, a no-kill municipal shelter specializing in pet adoptions, licensing, humane education, and more. Located at 511 West, 3900 South in Salt Lake City. More information is at AdoptUtahPets.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about what happened yesterday, oral arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court in the case of the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. You all know the story. A Colorado baker refused to make a custom cake for a same-sex couple that they were getting married. We're talking about this case, what we may have been able to tell by the arguments made yesterday. Let's talk about race. This is interesting. So the Solicitor General for the United States, General Noel Francisco, representing the Trump administration, made this argument that if this were about race, it would be different. That race is a compelling interest. Like if the baker had refused to make a cake and the couple, like even a same-sex couple, were mixed race or of a particular race, then that would be different. I don't think that went over very well with the justices, it seemed to me, or did it?
He did use what I considered a very bizarre example, which was an African-American sculptor who was asked by some group of KKK members to make a cross. I didn't know exactly where that was going, and I didn't really understand how that helped in this case, to be really frank about it. But race certainly got attention because there seems to be this new thread of race as a not just compelling interest, but I'm going to say super compelling interest, that race is in a class of its own and it's very, very special. And anything we say about same-sex couples or same-sex marriages, gay rights generally, it does not rise to the same interest or, you know, sort of scrutiny, if you will, as you would have for race. And the interesting thing, the move that I found fascinating, is they drew on a case from last term called Peña Rodriguez, in which the court said, very different circumstances, also a case out of Colorado. We are not going, you know, typically the rule is that we do not impeach jury verdicts. This is a lot about not watching the sausage being made.
Yeah.
And yet, if somebody says racist things, and those
which
are
one
reported,
juror did.
Exactly. That is so important. We're going to go through, you know, we're going to say hundreds of years of precedent that said we don't impeach jury verdicts for this particular unique circumstance, because of the role of race in our society, we just have to allow impeaching of the jury verdict. And that was a Kennedy opinion. And they said, we're going to use that to our advantage here.
I think a big piece of what's perplexing here is whether this is about identity of customer or whether this is about an act. And we see that coming out in the oral argument in a number of ways. And we actually see the Solicitor General arguing something slightly different than what the baker's attorney is arguing. So Jack Phillips repeatedly in his public statements has said, this is not about my animus towards gay people or towards Charlie or David. I would have been happy to sell them anything off the shelf, anything that was already created. I just didn't want to create something to put my imprimatur upon a gay marriage. It was my opposition to gay marriage that was at stake here. I didn't want to be forced to appear in favor of it when I'm not. So he's saying it's about the act, not the identity. But if it's about the act, if what he opposes is marriage, then it would seem that that has to come out the same way if it's a mixed race couple and they come in and he says, I'm opposed to that. It doesn't have to do with your identity. I'm opposed to your marriage based on the identity that is involved in your marriage. Then that's a very complicated – it's hard for me to understand as a constitutional matter how those two cases come out differently. And of course I would argue – of course, anybody in 2017 would argue that race has to be off the table, right? So you can see them sort of scrambling to try to figure out how they carve out race as different. But Jack's own position that this isn't about identity, that he's happy to serve gay customers in general, the constitutional right to – the Obergefell constitutional right to gay marriage is premised on a case called Loving, which is a case about interracial marriage. Yeah. They're identical.
Well, where's Kennedy on identity then?
Well, I mean, I think we also have to say not just do we have sort of a long history in terms of interracial marriage, the court has a bunch of cases that talk about different things with respect to interracial marriage and has been very clear about not, you know, how important it was at that time, especially right after Loving, to accommodate with respect to interracial. So I feel like there is too much precedent. There's too much of sort of cultural norms here to say interracial marriage would be treated the same. So they had to say, well, that's because race is super special and it's so different. And
that's I wonder how gay people feel about that, right?
I mean, this is a very good question. And it's not just gay folks, right? It's also gender.
Yep.
It's also all kinds of things where
national
race
origin,
is very different.
Religion, disability,
ethnicity.
The nature of identity.
The Solicitor Correct. General yeah. says in his oral argument comments yesterday that race is a standalone category. It would only be discrimination on the basis of race that would trump the free expression rights of the expressor like the baker. If it were discrimination on the basis of gender or national origin or religion or disability, the free expression rights would prevail.
Okay, let's go back to this exchange, which I wish I could have heard, and I can't wait until the audio finally does come out, because it was this exchange that was, I think it began when Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg asked, hey, who else is an artist? And then I guess Justice Kagan starts throwing out all these different kinds of jobs. What about a hairstylist? Ranelle, you were mentioning this before. But what about a chef? What about a makeup artist? What about the guy who sets up chairs or the waitstaff? I mean, it goes down the whole litany. And Jack Phillips' lawyer said that many of those jobs, in fact, are not entitled to speech protections, like a tailor or a chef, not entitled to speech protections. The tailor is not engaged in speech. This is Phillips' lawyer. Nor is a chef engaged in speech. At which point, apparently, Justice Kagan jumps in and said, whoa, the baker is engaged in speech, but the chef is not engaged in speech. So that seems like a bit of skepticism on the part of the court there.
I mean, I think that the tailors are probably pretty upset about this because, you know, if they're getting thrown under the bus, you think that they can't embroider things into a suit or into clothes. And in fact, I believe that that happens on occasion, right? That people have very special things embroidered into dresses and into the suit that you wear for.
Well, how is fashion not an expression?
I mean, that's it's
architecture, not art.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually, we have a name for this in the law. It's called the slippery slope, yeah. Right? And we have a concern that we have to, what the justices are really concerned about isn't this set of things, but the sort of far edge. I mean, what if a guy selling widgets at, you know, a random hardware store starts to say, I also am expressive in this. They want to have some boundary that they can articulate, and they're having a very hard time because a cake is a terrible context in which to have to describe that boundary.
And if I could, I think we should think about this in a way that was suggested by the guys who run the First Monday's podcast, Dan Epps and Ian Samuel. It may be that part of the reaction that we have to this particular case is that it is in a wedding context. Yeah. We have lots of cultural sort of expectations. In fact, I might argue that commercially we make much of your wedding being your unique expression of yourself,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And then you can also, and that came out in the argument, But you could also tie this to the long history of things like weddings, funerals, baptisms or bris, right, that have
ritual,
long religious tradition and history behind them. And one thing that did not come up in the argument, but I think might be something that Kennedy could possibly explore, is whether these kinds of events, because the line drawing is so hard with respect to like who's in and who's out at a wedding, if they were to say Baker's going to win, but Baker wins because in a certain very limited group of events, right, that have these long religious traditions, we're just going to say those aren't part of the public accommodations law and they have to be sort of separated out. Now, that blends back in the religion question, but that might be a way to avoid that line that we're trying to draw here.
Let me quote Justice Sotomayor, who said, "When have we ever given protection to a food?"
That's the problem.
Right?
You're going to do it for the food, but you won't do it for the clothes.
And it's
You're
a rhetorical it question, but of course the answer is never.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Of course. Okay. So let's get to what you think is going to happen. I mean, Justice Kennedy said in an exchange with Mr. Cole, who was speaking on behalf of the Colorado, right?
Of the couple.
Of the couple. Forgive me. Justice Kennedy said in an exchange with Mr. Cole, "It's not their identity. It's what they're doing. I think your identity thing is just too facile."
Mm-hmm.
So where do you think Kennedy's – and that he's the one that matters, as I said earlier. Where is he going to come down, do you figure?
So I'll lead off because I'm willing to be wrong, and you can replay it when I'm wrong. But I think it's going to be – I mean, obviously it's 5-4. That would not be dangerous territory. I think this will all be in how Kennedy sort of writes it, right? My guess is that it's 5-4 in favor of the Baker. One would hope that he could come up with a clear way to distinguish things. But I think it, you know, the line drawing that we've just brought out in this last bit will make it ever so complicated. So my guess is if the Baker wins, we're going to get a Kennedy opinion that might be very hard to understand. And it may be very hard to apply going forward. That's my guess.
I think if I were laying money on it, I would lay money on it being 5-4 for the Baker, but I wouldn't lay very much money. And it's because so lots of the reports that I see have language in them from people who are present, like Kennedy looked troubled, they said at various points.
A lot of people said that, troubled.
And I don't know what that means, and there's no camera in the courtroom, so I can't see what that means. And I don't know how troubled he is by either position. I do think that several of the things that he said that seem to be very concerned about the religious freedom components and the religious liberty aspects and the capacity to dissent from a cultural norm, I think, is really important to him. I suspect it comes out 5-4. I actually, notwithstanding his tendency to write grand and important and big opinions, I think there's some possibility that he tries to thread the needle here and that we end up with some narrower, Solomonic accommodation that might not actually speak to the wider future, and then we have to wait for additional case law to play out the details.
So you agree with Amy in the sense that it might sound pretty confusing, not as majestic and kind of confusing.
And I don't – I mean, it may be that he does try to write that majestic opinion, and then it will be even more confusing.
Okay, so. We're out of time. Amy Wildermuth teaches law at the University of Utah. Rennell Anderson-Jones also teaches. Thank you both again for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.